Welcome to Rewind, a podcast of 90s nostalgia. My name is Mike Chin, and I'm here with my co-host, Mike Scalise. Mike, how are you doing today?
Good. How about you, Mike?
Doing all right, thanks. So we're here together, well, not really together in person, but here on Zoom together to record this thing. And we'll get past the heads up for any of our faithful listeners, in case you don't get to the end of the show, I'll say it right up front. This is going to be our final episode for now. We may end up recording some more down the road. I think we both had some fun with this project. We took it on as sort of a pandemic, kind of fun side project, in a way, kind of staying in touch and working on something. It's been good, but we've also both got busy lives. We're both fathers. We're both working full time, and it's a good bit to keep up on. So, if folks really like the show, and if we have other ideas, we very well might revisit this concept, sometime down the road. But consider this the end of season one. And I think it's a good note to end season one on, because when I think of 90s things, for me, even though he's by no means, restricted to the 90s, he's still active today, I think of Adam Sandler as a 1990s guy. I think his brand of humor, the peak of his popularity, his influence sort of on the culture, I think is being pretty localized to the 1990s. And to date, we're going to focus on four separate films of his. And this is a little bit arbitrary because he played supporting roles in a bunch of other movies, and he played the lead in a few other 90s movies. But the ones we're going to focus on here are Billy Madison, Happy Gilmore, The Wedding Singer, and Big Daddy, which for me, I sort of feel like is the Mount Rushmore of Adam Sandler movies, at least in the 1990s. We may talk a little bit about, kind of films from outside that period, but, not necessarily his best, although I think there's an argument to make that these are more or less his best ones, but nonetheless, sort of ones that represent what he did, his style of comedy, what kind of popularized him, so on and so forth. And we're also just focusing on, films that, just to clarify what an Adam Sandler movie means in this case, they're ones that he starred in and had some sort of hand in creatively. There's obviously, again, some omissions. The Waterboy was kind of number five on my list. I thought we maybe could have added on, but just for the sake of length of the episode. I know we're both familiar with kind of these four movies. It just made sense to kind of contain it to these four. But with all that, Mike, let me ask you, in terms of your exposure to Adam Sandler, what are your first memories of encountering this guy?
So I can tell you, even before he became a well-known actor, for sure my first interaction with anything Adam Sandler probably came in the early 90s with, he had an album called They're All Gonna Laugh at You. Mm-hmm. And so he had a series of tracks on that. I think there were like over 20 tracks where he would have like just little like bits about, there's one about, it was pretty bad.
There's the goat
actually.
And there's.
Yeah, there's the goat. There's, the longest pee. And it's like 2 minutes of, I think of him. Like peeing. Yeah. I don't remember exactly what each one was, but it's that kind of stuff. He had a song about Lunch Lady Land, the high school lunch lady. Right. And so, obviously not everybody's comedy. As a young person in the early 90s, you kind of hear some of these things and it just, for better or worse, it grabs your attention. So that was probably my first, foray or whatever into the Adam Sandler world. How about yourself?
Yeah. Similarly, it was before he kind of, broke out as a movie star. He was a stand-up comedian. I think I may have come across some elements of that, but Saturday Night Live was my first exposure to him. My family, we always watched Saturday Night Live, which in retrospect is kind of shady, is something that you would do as a family, especially by 1990s standards of decency. We would watch it pretty much every week. My parents would record it on Saturday night. We'd watch this time over the weekend. And he was one of those kind of standouts or sort of, you know, breakout stars from that show. I think he started right around 1990, or he was in the early 90s. And that's where he debuted, like, the Thanksgiving song and the Hanukkah song and things like that. I hit his whole opera man persona. You know, and there were a lot of other, pretty standout stars at that time. Like Chris Farley was on at that time. Dana White, Mike Myers, Dana Carvey, excuse me, I'm talking about the UFC guy, Dana White.
What about Phil Hartman?
Yeah, Phil Hartman was on around that time. Yeah, and so, I think Sandler kind of, stood out to me at least as, one of the personalities who, when he showed up on screen, was like, okay, this is going to be funny. Like he was one of the guys who was, reliably entertaining, kind of outlandish. I didn't see him as like a movie star kind of guy. And some of that is just, I was a kid. This is my first exposure, to this kind of comedy. So it's sort of, who knows, who was I to judge that sort of thing. When the movie started to come across, it was like, oh, okay. So this guy actually does have some ability to kind of stand out on his own and do his own thing. And I might be remembering this wrong, but I think the way that it played out with Billy Madison, which was, again, not his first movie, but I think the first one where he both had a decisive starring role and had a hand in the creative part of it. That you had seen it at some friend's house and kind of then exposed me to it. Do you remember it the same way, or maybe I've got that a little mixed up?
You know, to be honest, you may be remembering it correctly. It's just, I just don't remember, It's been, nearly 20 years or something like that. So,
right.
Or more than 20 years, actually, almost 30 years. It very well could be. It sounds like something that I probably saw somewhere and then introduced you to.
Yeah. If my family was kind of a wonky one with stuff like this, where, it'd be within our realm that we would watch Saturday Night Live, but like, a movie like Billy Madison, I can immediately see them kind of saying like, this is just like too lowbrow. This is no redeeming value, or we're not going to watch this, like just not being interested at all. Mm-hmm. And I feel like I had maybe heard of the movie and then, it was when we watched it together, it was like, wow, this is really funny. And not in an intelligent, funny kind of way, like so much of the comedy that would, follow and some of the stuff that I now sort of consider my favorite stuff. But just this kind of, this is so dumb, so random, kind of the way like Family Guy hit, I think, when, a lot of us were really into that show, where, it's funny just because of how outlandish it is at a certain point. That's kind of his style of humor, though. It's kind of, it's a little bit referential. We're going to call on something that, existed before. It's a little bit kind of gross out and just kind of, do something that's, kind of off the wall. It's a little bit, juvenile for sure. Anything else you would say about, what kind of appealed to you about Adam Sandler before we get into those specific movies?
Well, it's kind of like what you just said and what I had said before. It's that, whether you like that type of comedy or not, it catches your attention because it's so outlandish. And so, if we think about other people who have become famous over the years and who are just, very well known, another person that comes to mind is like Howard Stern. He was kind of crazy too, in terms of, he would say anything that he wanted to on the radio, and people generally didn't just say anything they wanted to. They had to adhere to some sort of rules and whatnot, but he just he didn't. So in any case, he's of that ilk where he just he's a little bit off the wall and it's going to catch your attention. And so, and then it becomes a question of, it's a judgment of, okay, is this something I want to continue listening to and watching or not? But either way, you've taken notice.
And I think you bring up a really good point. We compare it to something like Howard Stern, because, obviously, Howard Stern and Adam Sandler are very different personalities, in the grand scheme of things, but there was something about the 90s, I think, where there was some testing of boundaries, right? And in past episodes, we talked about basketball. That's when Dennis Rodman was kind of doing all his crazy, off-court antics and all that, and we talked about, American Pie is kind of the end of the 90s, and I feel like that's sort of, what it evolved into, is we're going to have these over-the-top, kind of, sexual jokes and, visuals and things like that. And in wrestling, at the end of the 90s, we get to, the Attitude Era and, Stone Cold Steve Austin drinking beer on screen and all kinds of stuff like that, where, yeah, it's a lot of kind of, the edgier product is kind of what's more popular, or at least people are experimenting with that during that time. And I think Adam Starr definitely has a place in that conversation. So let's, dive into, the first of the movies I've listed here, which I'm pretty sure was the first one I saw, and I imagine this first one that you saw, for sure it was the first of these to come out in 1995, Billy Madison. So as a general overview of the plot, and feel free to fill in some holes or correct me if you remember it differently, but, basically, this, guy who grows up a rich kid, has a, a ton of money through his family, is a complete moron, and sort of his dad buys his way through school to the extent that he gets through school, but then doesn't really see it any further through, doesn't really have a job, just kind of wastes his days getting drunk and hanging out with his friends, and then it all kind of comes to a head when his dad's gonna pass on the family business, and Adam Sandler's character Billy Madison has to sort of fight for the right for his family, and goes back to school, and sort of this pretty ludicrous set of circumstances, but the idea being he's going to go through all of the grades in a period of weeks to prove that he could have completed high school, as if that is proving that he's competent to run the family business, which all of this is obviously just kind of ridiculous, but fun, right? I mean, just the idea of this grown man being in like a first grade classroom with all these kids and on up the line from there. Again, I think it's that absurdist, kind of element that it's definitely feeding into. Any things that you think of with this movie in terms of, either points I missed there, or again, we can just dive into, favorite parts of this or what appealed to you about the film.
I generally like comedies. So that's, again, I was familiar with Adam Sandler. So that's, that was, I'm sure, the impetus to watch the movie, but I think that was a good synopsis. And I think it was if I'm remembering right, the family business, I think he owned a chain of hotels.
Certainly could be right. I honestly don't remember that. You would think that would be a major plot point, but I feel like you really don't need to know that.
No, you don't. And that speaks to they just create this, the animosity between a couple of characters, and then just the general stupidity and surface humor, and so the details don't really a lot of his movies, the details really don't matter. I think that was a good synopsis.
And from the opening scene of this thing, automatically you're thrust into this world of this guy where I think the implication is he's so drunk he's hallucinating, but he's chasing this giant penguin around the family compound or on the property surrounding their mansion, saying it's too hot for you to be out here, penguin, it's just ridiculous. And we see all of the workers that kind of belong to the house kind of getting out of his way or saying not again. So it's implied that this happens on a fairly regular basis. So. We get a pretty clear sense of the character immediately from that. And we get his deadbeat kind of friends who just sort of hang out with him and, laugh at stuff. As much as obviously the portrayal of it is over the top, I think this is a dynamic that we can kind of get. We all have friends who are just kind of that kind of idiot, right? Who will just, look at something, their friend doing something really stupid and over the top and just laugh at it rather than being like, maybe we should do something more constructive for society or for our own, betterment. That's not on these guys' radar, right? It's just kind of all about enjoying life in that way.
And with the means to do it. I mean, that's the thing, right? I think it's relatable because not only do we all have friends kind of like that, but like that's how we would imagine a friend like that with money, with that kind of money. how it would kind of play out. And I mean, it's over the top a bit, but we could see it,
But I do like that. I mean, I'm probably giving the movie too much credit here, but I would suggest there's a little bit of almost class commentary there, right? Where it's like, you think the rich people are all hoity-toity and, no Shakespeare and are super educated and so on and so forth. And it's like, well, no, this guy could just as easily be, you know, coming from, you know, a trailer park and, you know, with no money and no means and still be living kind of the same sort of life, right? Like he wouldn't have the nice swimming pool or the golf cart or anything like that, but still be living kind of a dopish life. So like, this is just a guy who, you know, is living a comfortable life through no kind of value of his own by not, you know, it's a merit to any of his hard work. This is just kind of the life some people get to have. But yeah, you know, I mean, obviously I've got, you know, some ideas kind of, you know, I left for myself here, but, you know, other, you know, things that, you know, kind of stood out to you or, you know, favorite moments from this movie or, you know, favorite gags or quotes or anything like that.
You know, I think there's a few that, that I really liked, but, you know, and in the past couple of episodes, you know, I think I tend to focus on some of the really positives. I don't know why, maybe that's just the stage of life I'm in, or because I'm a parent now, but one thing about that he did in this movie that I really thought was kind of neat was where, you know, he's going back to school, making his way through all the grades. And there was one point where I think they all had, the class had taken a field trip. Mm-hmm. And one of the kids peed his pants. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, Billy noticed it, and he, I mean, again, being a kind of a crazy guy anyway, who actually might pee his own pants. I mean, who knows, but probably not, but being an adult and understanding that and wanting the kid to feel comfortable or feel okay about having done that, you know, he splashed water on his own pants and made it into a cool thing. And then everybody peed their pants, and it's, you know, it's just like, again, as a kind of an older individual now and a parent, you know, it's like, we don't care as much, like we don't feel the embarrassment, but sure, a kid going through elementary school and middle school, like that could be like catastrophic for the rest of his, yeah, you know, school life. So, you know, the fact that he kind of did that for the kid, I thought was really great. And I know we're going to talk about like Big Daddy as another movie eventually in this episode, but I kind of like to, I like looking back on the movie and seeing moments like that, you know, more so than him, you know, kissing a penguin he's hallucinating about, or not even him kissing it, but, or Chris Farley kissing a penguin that he's hallucinating about, you know. So how about yourself?
Well, yeah, no, I was just going to comment on that. I feel like, you know, that's kind of a redeeming moment for the character. And I think in the other movies we're going to talk about, and then even all the more so in some of his later films after the ones we're going to talk about, I think we see more of that kind of, you know, at heart, he's a good guy, right? Like he does some stupid things, and, you know, not everything he does is, you know, morally on the up and up. But, you know, he's got a good heart, and he ultimately, you know, does the right thing when it's important. Billy Madison, I actually feel the least strongly overall about that character, that he does that. Like at the end of the day, if this were a real person, I feel like he probably really shouldn't get this family business. But that's one of those handful of moments, though, that I think where you're exactly right. You kind of hit the nail on the head, that they're kind of revealing, like, no, at the end of the day, he's a nice guy. Like he sees a kid who, you know, is in a rough spot. He tries to help him out. Right. And it's, mm-hmm, you know, awkward way, in a way that's, you know, kind of, you know, not the most polished way, but, you know, clearly he's got the right sentiment there when he does, yep, that. But yeah, you know, just to motor through, you know, and feel free to weigh in at some other ones as well, but, you know, there's the whole scene with him interacting with Chris Farley as the bus driver there, which is such a throwaway piece of the movie, because Farley's only in this movie for, you know, probably a cumulative like 5 or 6 minutes, but I think he's really a scene stealer in this movie. Like he's really, you know, someone who is kind of magnetic in that role. And, you know, they're talking about the teacher, Veronica Vaughn. He's like, that Veronica Vaughn. And, you know, just goes on and on about how attractive she is and what he wants to do with her. Like, you know, and Adam Sandler keeps like, just kind of cutting him off and being like, you've never done that. Like you don't know that about her.
No, you haven't.
It's another kind of, I guess, hint that Adam Sandler's character, Billy Madison, is kind of a good guy there. But that bus driver is totally believable too, right? Like that, again, we all, I think, have friends where, you know, if they see an attractive woman, they're going to start talking like that, especially, you know, in that stage of life, you know. And I think that character is really funny. Obviously not very likable, but, you know, humorous in his delivery.
Well, not to mention that he's like stealing the kids' lunches and like eating all the kids' lunches.
But then he makes that cameo later on in the movie where he does sort of a striptease for Adam Sandler, where he's trying to help him study. Like,
oh, that's right. I forgot. You know, about
so I mean, he's just way over the top, and obviously not a realistic character. I don't think. I mean, everything's kind of exaggerated in the world of this movie. Yeah, you know, for me, obviously, you know, being a big pro wrestling fan through the years, the whole Revolting Blob character and the implications that the principal of the elementary school moonlights as a professional wrestler, I just think that's kind of fun. I think that's, you know, an entertaining, you know, bit of this thing. Steve Buscemi, who, you know, he went on to become, or, you know, maybe he always was, but at least have better renown as a pretty serious actor. But at this point in, you know, working with Adam Sandler, he's just playing these kind of crazy characters who, are outcasts and sort of, you know, even by Adam Sandler standards, weird. You know, he plays this kid who Adam Sandler had picked on when they were in school together. And you know, he's got a list posted to his wall of people to kill, and crosses off Billy Madison's name after he calls to apologize to him. Yeah, you know, it's so over the top and kind of ridiculous, but you know, it's especially at that time when at least for you and me, I think we hadn't really seen anything like it before, just really funny in that moment, because of how outlandish it is.
And I'll also point to the, you know, while we're just listing a few characters or actors and actresses, you remember Miss Lippy, I think was her name. She's the one of the, I forgot which grade, but one of the teachers, when she was putting like glue on her like eyelids and her face. It's just, I mean, to your point before about, you know, you have this kind of, you know, goofy main character that is Adam Sandler. And then, but you have all these other actors that are even more so, like,
right,
like where he's looking at them and he's like, yeah, it's a little weird. You know, like, if that's not a testament to how over the top the whole movie is, really.
Yeah. You know, and last thing I'll say for Billy Madison, you know, we arrive at kind of the climactic part of it is this academic decathlon where, you know, Adam Sandler's character is competing with Bradley Whitford's, you know, villainous character. And the idea is whichever one of them, you know, wins this kind of combination of all the different school subjects. So there's trivia and there's, you know, delivering a speech, and there's, you know, athletic components of it. But whoever wins, you know, gets the company. And it has that one iconic line that's become sort of a meme now where, you know, the person who's moderating the debate portion of it, you know, after Adam Sandler gives his whole speech about the little train, whatever it is, the book that he cites, you know, cites that it was just complete nonsense. And then they give the whole, you know, musical montage, make it sound like it's a big inspirational speech. But then after he's done, the moderator just says, you know, everyone in this room is now dumber for having heard what you said.
I think
probably stands out as like the standout line of the movie, at least in my mind.
I'm really going from memory here. Are you talking about the puppy who lost its way?
Yeah, that's right. That's what it is. That's the book. Yeah.
Yep. And then, yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, he gave this final summary, and yeah, that, and then became the, and then that line became kind of like a common phrase to say.
Yeah, it's the kind of thing where, like nowadays, when I teach students, a lot of times I try to pull in like things that I find humorous, like comic strips or, you know, like little clips from movies or whatnot. You know, and there's been a number of instances where they say like, oh, that's where that came from. Because like I've seen like a meme that has that image or has that quote, but I didn't know what that was ever from, and which blows my mind because it's like stuff like, well, you haven't seen like this movie or you haven't ever, you know, been to this website. But I think that's that kind of thing, right? I bet if I showed it to, you know, a bunch of people who were born, you know, in the year 2000 and later, where like they very well might recognize, you know, a still image of, you know, that moderator at that panel saying, you know, everyone's now dumber for having heard that, but they wouldn't know Billy Madison rather. But yeah, I was starting to get ahead of myself there, but you know, on to Happy Gilmore. And I remember, I don't know if you ever had this conversation, but I remember we were talking to some of my high school friends or, you know, again, around this time, there was some degree of debate between, you know, Billy Madison and Happy Gilmore, and, you know, which is the better movie or which is the funnier movie. You know, cause they were sort of Adam Sandler's, you know, two breakout kind of, you know, performances where he was the lead character. He had a hand in it creatively. They came out in back-to-back years. So it sort of does invite, you know, a degree of comparison. And the breakdown often that I heard, or that I kind of started getting on the argument about, was, you know, Billy Madison is sort of just a random assemblage of funny things. Like there is an overarching plot, but it's almost incidental. Like again, the whole hotel business thing, I didn't remember it, but you know, probably should have been pretty important. Whereas with Happy Gilmore, it's more of a conventional movie in terms of, you know, having a straightforward plot, you know, moving in a linear fashion, but still having a lot of the over-the-top, you know, kind of humorous stuff and, you know, absurdist characters and all of that going on. But yeah, you know, and for you, let's let you start out with Happy Gilmore. You know, what do you remember about this film? You know, what stands out to you? Anything along those lines?
Well, you know, so it's based on, I mean, a lot of the movie, let's just say, revolves around really kind of two sports, initially hockey, mm-hmm. and then followed by golf. And I can tell you, those are two sports that I have never really been interested in.
Yeah.
So really, this was a movie for me about more so about the actors and actresses and kind of the storyline separate from the specifics of the sports. Comedy.
I'll quickly weigh in on that. I don't mean to interrupt you there, but I'll say,
no, go ahead.
You know, I think in a way, that's the extent to which it operates similar to Billy Madison. It's taking someone and putting them in a position where they're completely out of their element, right? So in Billy Madison, it's this grown man who was terrible at school and putting him into a school setting. So he both stands out for his age and because he's not at all academically inclined anyway, so he's just a complete fish out of water. And the whole hockey, golf, you know, dichotomy, so similarly, I don't really follow either one of those sports. But if I had to pick, you know, polar opposite mainstream sports, like that ranks, right? Like golf is like the gentleman's sport where everyone, you know, claps politely and stays quiet when people are actually playing and all that. And hockey is like the, you know, you can go there just to watch the fights essentially, and, you know, and be reasonably entertained by that. So taking this character who's, you know, considers himself a hockey player, that's always wanted to do, and then plugging him into the golf world because he just happens to be naturally really good at it. You know, is kind of a similarity in plot point, I think, of, again, just kind of taking this character and putting them in an absurdist situation because it's so much the opposite of what they're naturally going to do. But yeah, I didn't mean to step on what you were saying there. So please carry on.
No. So that's, so anyway, but you know, again, despite the specifics of the sport, and they did it in such a way that it wasn't, I don't think it was boring at all. Mm-hmm. And there were lots of other elements to the movie, that were, that seemed, you know, enticing or whatever. So I don't remember the first time that I saw it, but I do agree with you from what you said earlier about, you know, they did come out, I think in back-to-back years, and it was like, which one's your favorite? Like, those are the two. And, you know, Billy Madison or Happy Gilmore. I happen to fall on the Billy Madison side of the equation. You know, for now, but it's not to say that Happy Gilmore is by any means like a boring movie or a horrible movie. Although I think it did either win an award or get nominated for an award for worst movie or something like that. Like a Razz.
I thought you were gonna go in the direction of like an Academy Award or something.
No, I don't think that's right. No, it's for a different competition.
Yeah.
but anyway, yeah.
No, but you know, and it's funny because I think when I was most into these movies, like in my teenage years, I would have voted for Billy Madison in the end. And it's funny because like as a slightly older person now, well, not slightly, I guess, you know, I should admit I'm a good 20 years older than that now. You know, now I actually do gravitate more towards Happy Gilmore. And I think that there is an element of, like, when I was a teenager, when I was first exposed to these things, like it being fun how random Billy Madison was. And now it's sort of being more rewarding of like, well, no, I kind of want a story. Like, I kind of want some redeeming value to this thing. And so, it's purely a matter of opinion. I don't think anyone can make a very reasonable argument that either of them are great movies by any objective standard. But I think I kind of fall on the opposite end of the fence on that one, just after, you know, all this time has passed. But yeah, I mean, one thing with Happy Gilmore is that there's definitely a casting upgrade here, right? Because there are some, you know, legitimate, you know, stars in, you know, Billy Madison kind of hidden throughout. But Happy Gilmore, you know, we have, you know, Carl Weathers as the golf coach there. We have, you know, Julie Bowen, who, you know, I think both of us would go on to find most famous for Modern Family, but, you know, she's the love interest in this one. So someone who actually, you know, had a, you know, a recognizable career beyond this moment. You know, in that kind of role, there's, who else was I thinking of? Christopher McDonald.
Bob Barker.
McGavin. Yeah, Bob Barker makes an appearance. Ben Stiller's the other one I was thinking of.
As, oh, yes, yes.
The nursing home attendant. So, I mean, there's all these people who, you know, I don't think they had peaked in their fame yet, except for Carl Weathers. He was, you know, he was already, I think, kind of past his peak. But, you know, for the most part, people had, you know, not yet peaked. And so I think just by association with Sandler kind of being in the comedy universe at that point, found their way into this film. And it's a deceptively kind of deep cast, especially for kind of people who just make really brief appearances in it. There's that. So I mean, there's, I think, maybe the most iconic line here of this thing is the whole tap it in thing, where, you know, Carl Weathers' character, Chubbs, is coaching Adam Sandler on how to putt. And you just tap it in, it goes just way over the top. And it feels like it's almost a sexual innuendo at one point, and just, it's kind of uncomfortable, but, you know, I think that might be the thing I feel like I hear quoted the most from this movie. But there are all kinds of other, you know, I think really funny moments embedded throughout here. You know, the whole thing with Ben Stiller in that nursing home and sort of, you know, treating it like a sweatshop essentially, and getting all of the old people to, you know, make things that he's going to sell. And, the woman who complains her fingers hurt, and he gives her the, you know, kind of tease, like, oh, your fingers hurt? Well, now who pulled landscaping duty? Does anybody else's fingers hurt? Like, it's again, so over the top as like a villainous character there, but I think, you know, kind of lays the template for
that. That was a little too realistic for me, Mike, there.
Like, oh, okay. I mean, it could be, right?
I mean, just like your reenactment of that, like.
Oh, I've seen this movie a few times.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, I was going to say, I mean, I feel like that almost laid a template for the character he would play in Dodgeball years later, where, you know, when I think of Ben Stiller, I think more of like his Something About Mary character, was kind of the, you know, the doofy, nice guy and all that. But he does have that in him to play kind of the over-the-top comedic villain. And I think that this was, at least to me, the first I'd seen him in that kind of role. But other things that for you that, you know, stand out or you liked from this movie?
I mean, yeah, I, you know, like you said, there are plenty of lines in this movie kind of to quote. You know, there's one where Shooter McGavin, you know, he says, they're kind of going back and forth, him and Adam Sandler's character. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he says, oh, I eat pieces of shit for you, like you for breakfast. And, right. You know, Adam Sandler, of course, comes back with, oh, you eat pieces of shit for breakfast. And he doesn't know what to say after that. No. So that's, I mean, you know, it's just in the comeback world, I thought, you know, that was kind of funny, and it's something that has stuck with me. And then the other one is, and I don't remember it exactly, but it's just, again, it's just, I feel like they do it just for the comedic value. But, you know, there's a point where Shooter is talking to, and by the way, Shooter McGavin is in the movie a pro golfer that's kind of, making his way up the ranks and trying to earn a master's earn that green jacket.
He's like the top golfer of the day, but hasn't yet won the
right. Game. But now that Billy Madison has kind of entered the ring, so to speak, and, you know, he's got a really long drive because he uses like a hockey stick based driver and can often get it on the green in the first, you know, a tee off or whatever.
The initial drive.
And so you know, so these two are going back and forth throughout the whole movie. But there's another scene where Shooter is saying something like, and I'll see you later today, listen to what I say. And then Billy Madison is like, shall we meet down by the bay? We just may, I don't know, what do you say? Like, it's just like a continuous like flow of rhyme. I know I butchered that completely, but
no.
Like, it's just, you know, it's just, nobody misses an opportunity to take a jab at the other person kind of throughout the whole movie, I think.
Well, no, and the thing, and I think a big part of the appeal of this movie and kind of its you know, staying power, you know, it's named Happy Gilmore, and you know, Adam Sandler is clearly the star of the film, but the Shooter McGavin character, I think, is one of the greatest foils for an Adam Sandler style character, just because he's so embraces the kind of that douchey role, right? Where you know, he's all kind of prim and proper, but he's also kind of a jerk. And it shows more and more in the movie, you know, and there's those moments that you pointed out where he's in conflict with, you know, Happy Gilmore. And by all indications, like, he's smarter than Happy, he's more experienced than Happy. He should be able to kind of, you know, just sort of dismiss this guy. But both between, you know, what Happy Gilmore can do on the golf course and just, you know, having kind of snappier comebacks, he does kind of own him over and over again throughout the movie. And there's that other piece I just love where it's the, what's the actor's name? Richard Kyle, the kind of giant guy who, you know, is a Happy Gilmore fan. I think he used to be his boss or superintendent or something like that. But in any event, there's a scene where he has a confrontation with Shooter as well. And, you know, and Shooter says he can count on it. And he comes back, it's like, you can count on me waiting for you in the parking lot. And it just shuts him up, right? Because it's like, you know, it's a character who, you know, has a big mouth, is very skilled at the game of golf. But in a fight with this giant, like, he's done. Like he doesn't have a chance. And so these people can kind of shut him down by kind of these, you know, more everyman kind of means.
Yep. And meanwhile, you have a character like the dude who's always like, hey, Shooter, hey, you want to go to Red Lobster? Like, where did that guy come from?
Right.
Shooter's like, no, it's okay. I'll pass. Thanks.
Right.
So, by the way, you know, Shooter McGavin, so Christopher McDonald is the person who plays him. Mm-hmm. He actually graduated not far away from where I live, and he went to Hobart College in Geneva.
Okay.
So, and he grew up in Romulus, which is like in the Finger Lakes region of New York.
Yeah, right.
So he has roots like here upstate. And I've actually had a few friends that have been to some bars in that area when he has come into town and have shot me
That's
like pictures
cool.
and whatnot. Yeah. So, I mean, you know, for it's cool. And even if he were the same type of guy in real life, which I heard he's not, like I would still be kind of cool to meet him or whatever, but it's kind of cool. Well, that
it's a funny thing with him because, I mean, he was in a lot of movies. And I think he was actually like a more serious actor. But I think this is now the role he's best known for. And it's such kind of an inversion. And you always have to wonder in a situation like that. Like this is not a perfect comparison, but, you know, years back, you know, I published a piece for BuzzFeed, you know, about the best WrestleMania matches and just kind of ranking them all. You know, I had fun doing it. I worked hard on it and all, but it kind of blew up and was by far the most read thing I had written at that point, and maybe still to date. You know, and in some ways that's cool when it's like, okay, people recognize me for that. People know about that thing. But on the other hand, it also gets to this point of like, I don't know if I want to be known for that. Like I've done more important stuff. I've written whole books. Like couldn't you know me for that? And I wonder if there's a little bit of that for someone like Christopher McDonald, where it's like, you know, I was actually a pretty serious actor. I like was, you know, I don't know if he's actually nominated for Academy Awards or anything, but like I could imagine he may have been. But you just know me for this, you know, villain role in an Adam Sandler movie. Like, great, you know.
You know what? This is a weird parallel, and it's definitely not the exact same, but kind of similar. I was just thinking about how many. Follow me here. How many restaurants go like? Have like whose purpose is one thing, but they're known for something else. Like I've heard people talk about Arby's fries or, right. you know, Olive Garden's breadsticks. Like, right. I don't think Olive Garden set out to be known most for their breadsticks. I mean, they have a zillion menu items, but right. like everybody talks about the breadsticks, you know, and, you know, I feel like there's a few more that are kind of like that where, you know, there's a difference between, you know, quality and popularity in a way.
Right,
and
right.
so, you know, something could be very popular, but it doesn't mean it's your best work kind of thing.
No, well, no, as a business, you got to roll with these things, I feel like. You know,
right.
I've never met Christopher McDonald. I don't really know much about him. you as a person, but I hope he embraces it, because I feel like it'd be kind of miserable if he didn't. take ownership over, and it's like, yeah, that's me. Well, the last thing I'll say about Happy Gilmore, the song Tuesday's Gone, it's one of my favorites. It's a Lynyrd Skynyrd song. They play it over the opening credits, when they're kind of getting a montage of like Happy's life up until, you know, the action of the movie, and they play it again over the closing when they pull up to the house. And I had heard the song before this, and I think it's one of those situations where I had heard it before, but not long before I saw the movie. So they kind of just you know, synced up for me. It's like, oh, I recognize that song. And it's like, I know, I really like that end of that movie. And I've always kind of had it in my head. Like, it's a pretty sad song if you listen to it more objectively speaking. But sort of this kind of sense of satisfaction and having kind of accomplished something, you know, at the end of the movie, he's, you know, won the big golf tournament. He's got enough money to buy back his grandma's house. They're moving back in, you know, just kind of this song that kind of represents all of that kind of feeling. So in any event, I think that, you know, it's a silly movie, but that stands as a more serious element of it, to me. Mm-hmm. But carrying on our, you know, thing of, you know, silly movies, you know, the Wedding Singer, you know, comes out in 1998. It's all set in the 1980s, and they have a lot of fun with kind of, you know, taking little jabs at, you know, things that, well, that'll never happen. You know, talking about like the band Van Halen and then breaking up and things like that, and, you know, and it's all kind of clearly, you know, done tongue in cheek to kind of, you know, show like, well, no, this is recorded, you know, nearly two decades after the 80s, or I guess more than a decade after, I should say. But in any event, So this movie, you know, it's a pretty simple premise, like most of these movies, but the Adam Sandler, you know, is a wedding singer. Again, we call the first one Billy Madison. The main character is named Billy Madison. The second one's Happy Gilmore. The main character is named Happy Gilmore. The third one, you call it The Wedding Singer because he is a wedding singer. So, you know, not the most creative titles necessarily, but they do tell you what the movie is, at least. Like, you can always remember, you know, who the main character is. But yeah, so yeah, with this, you know, he's a successful wedding singer. Then he gets left at the altar when he's supposed to get married, and then it's just kind of a story of sort of his comeback, right? And him kind of you know, falling in love with Drew Barrymore's character, and, you know, everything that happens in between. So any initial thoughts, reactions on The Wedding Singer?
You know, I like this movie for a whole kind of different reason. Even though it was, you know, kind of a comedy, I maybe because it was kind of set in the 80s, but it just had a different feel to me. It wasn't just joke after joke over the top kind of thing. I mean, it was funny, and there were definitely several scenes in it that that I liked and laughed at, but it did have that, it had like kind of a very I don't know, like, I liked the storyline, I guess, about it, you know, of it. Well, you know, I mean, it's, get left at the altar,
I feel like this one tips that balance. Like I said, you know, Billy Madison, it's mostly jokes loosely held together by a story. And Happy Gilmore, I'd say, is on the other side of that line, where it's still kind of mostly jokes, but the storyline is prominent. Like we do, you can track this thing, you know, linearly, it makes sense. What Wedding Singer, I think you're right. It kind of takes that next step forward where it really, it's a real movie. Like there is a real plot. There is a real love story that kind of evolves, you know, a lot more organically than I suggest it does in the preceding films. And it still has a lot of absurdist humor kind of built into it, but it does feel like that the story, we've really tipped, it's no longer just like a balance between the two. Now it really is first and foremost a more conventional movie that still has all of these elements of humor.
Right, right, exactly. I kind of like, I wouldn't say I'm a huge Drew Barrymore fan, but I do like the dynamic between these two. And clearly other people did too. In that, you know, they, I think in 50 First Dates, they kind of reunited for that movie too. So yeah, I don't know. It was just a very enjoyable movie to watch for a variety.
I think that, you know, I think you're on point with Drew Barrymore being sort of, you know, yeah, as much as, you know, Julie Bowen went on to successful TV career, you know, and we'll get to Joey Lauren Adams in, you know, Big Daddy, but Drew Barrymore, I think, you know, at this point when she was recording this film, was probably the biggest star that had been attracted to be the love interest for an Adam Sandler movie up to that point. You know, and I think it shows because she sort of has that magnetic star quality. She's, you know, comes across as an equal, if not even greater star than Adam Sandler, I feel like, in a film like this. So, yeah, I think that's a good read on that relationship. But yeah, and so I'm going to spitball a couple of my favorite. Just kind of, this is a movie where I think, like you said, it's got a compelling plot. It's got some real emotion kind of packed into it. And then I think maybe that's why the standalone lines that do come out of it as kind of quotes that like really stand out to me less as like a whole scene than just like this exact moment, in the movie. So I'm going to say just two of them from really early on. There's the initial wedding where Adam Sandler is kind of on his game as a successful wedding singer. And Steve Buscemi is back again in an Adam Sandler movie, and he's playing the best man who's, very intoxicated and kind of bitter about his place in life, and going on a little bit of a tirade when he gives the best man speech. And there's just this throwaway moment, throwaway line where he's talking about, the best man, more like the better man. And that just always cracks me up. You can't say that line and I'm not going to find it funny. And I think at your wedding, I think I said that line to you when I came up to give my speech. And that's how ingrained that this thing is in my speech,
at least. Because you were my best man. And
that's true. You were my best man too. I don't know if you're the one who said it at my wedding.
The better man. No.
Yeah, that's right.
That is a funny line.
Yeah. But the one other one I'll say from the beginning stages of the movie, and then I want to hand it over to you for some of your picks. The old woman he's coaching in singing, because she's going to sing for her anniversary party with her husband, and she doesn't have any money, so she pays him in meatballs. And I just love that moment in this thing where she just goes over and he's kind of doing the play like, no, you don't have to, or we can do it some other time. And just, carries the ladle over with these meatballs and just dumps them into his hands. And he's just standing there.
Hold out your hands.
Right. He's just standing there with these meatballs in his hands, dripping with sauce. It's like, what am I going to do here?
Well, he takes a bite of one.
Right. He does. Yeah.
But
it feels relatable to me that, I haven't had that exact situation happen to me, but of the, that she's just trying to be nice. It kind of reveals a little bit about his character that he's a nice guy, because if he were, a Shooter McGavin style character, he'd probably just, toss him back at her or throw him in the trash or something. He wants to protect her feelings. Like, oh yeah, this is great. Thank you so much for the meatballs. But at the same time, it's also like, now I'm a sopping mess of like sauce and meat. And I've got these in my hands. I can't get rid of them until I'm out of your sight. Like, what am I going to do? I just think it's just a really funny kind of awkward moment in that movie.
Yep. I couldn't agree more. And you know what's interesting to me, and this is a little bit of a stretch, but when you talk about how, the sentiment is there or whatnot, the lady is trying to be nice, trying to repay him. And the viewers know that's kind of messed up to just plop two gigantic meatballs directly in somebody's hands. But you just kind of know, and oddly enough, I don't know why, but I feel like when I watch shows like Modern Family, I feel like they're very, there's elements of that show too, that where, there's certain scenes where like things are maybe not quite perfect, not quite super over, produced and whatnot. And it's, I wonder if they're trying to tap into the viewers, when you record something, you a lot of times you set out to be perfect, you want things to, have no errors or nothing weird or whatever. And in that movie, they're not afraid to evoke that kind of weirdness or whatever, under the guise of, a nice compliment or act of gratitude. And I feel like Modern Family kind of also does that. Like, they're not afraid to, they have Phil, the goofy character, father, who's, does a lot of just really funny things, and a lot of the characters, they just seem very real. And again, I wonder if that's to really kind of tap into the viewers, something inside the viewers where they're like, yeah, that is actually, what could happen with some old lady who, is trying to just be nice to you. I don't know.
Well, no, it's a little bit of a tangent, because obviously, Modern Family isn't, something, a product of the 90s, it's probably, much more recently, just went off the air this past year, but Let me flesh out my thought before I hand back to you. I think that a part of the appeal of that show is, despite modern being in the title and despite, you know, kind of depicting a lot of more modern, you know, dynamics, like there's a gay couple that has adopted, you know, a child from abroad, for example, and there are major characters in the show. I still feel like the sensibility of the show is a little bit more 90s in sort of, you know, sort of an innocence kind of packed in there and sort of, you know, before things kind of got edgy. Like, I think that there's a fair amount of kind of the DNA of a show like Full House kind of packed into a show like Modern Family, just, you know, put into a more, you know, modern format and a little bit more polished. But let me ask, did you kind of see that show all the way through, or did you kind of stop at a certain point, or what was your experience with Modern Family?
Well, I did not see it all the way through. I think I got something like 5 seasons in, or something, yeah. Maybe 6 seasons
you,
in.
You stopped at the right point, because...
did it go in a different direction?
Because the thing is, I think that for the first, I don't know exactly, 4 or 5 seasons, I think that it was a really, really good show for what it was. Yeah, you know, I don't think it was like breaking any new ground necessarily, but I think that it was... a funny show, and I think, you know, largely a well-written show. I think they capitalized on the kind of dynamics that you're, you know, talking about pretty well. But I'm just checking this here, because I think it was 11 seasons or 12 seasons even. I can't see it really quickly, but regardless, it was in that ballpark of number of seasons. And I remember there was a point where I stopped watching it, you know, regularly, and then I kind of tuned back in and was like, they're kind of just making the exact same jokes over again. Like, and it's just not executed quite as well. It's not quite as organic. And so I just sort of stopped watching it all together. And then I came back and I watched the last episode when it originally aired. It had its moments and it's, you know, sort of sentimental to see characters you really like, you know, kind of do their thing for the last time. But it was also just kind of bad. Like I just feel like it was kind of stale at this point. It just didn't land in the same way it once did.
Okay.
And I think that sort of speaks to, you know, a shift in format for comedy, where I feel like if Adam Sandler were coming up now, he would absolutely have his own TV show. But I feel like that's just kind of the way things have gone, be it, you know, a Netflix kind of series or be it a more conventional cable series. Someone would lure him in with enough money to just, you know, produce, you know, the Wedding Singer, the show, essentially. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it'd probably be really funny for a season and then would kind of disintegrate because we've told the jokes. You've already seen what the show has to offer. And I think that's something that is a little bit lost of kind of, you know, that 90s culture of sometimes it's okay to settle for just 1 or 2 movies and then be done with something, right? I think that now we kind of have this culture of we're just going to keep churning out sequel after sequel, or we're going to make this into a 5-year TV series. But it doesn't need to be, and it's probably better off not being, because by the time it's done, we no longer, you know, really love it the way we originally did. So, you know, that's my 2 cents.
Yeah.
Beyond the scope of the show, but, you know, kind of my read on that.
Yeah, and I wonder how much, honestly, how much, like, money plays into all of that.
I think money dominates in that conversation, you know, and this is sort of a nice way of bookending our show, because we started talking about NBA, and I'm going to bring us back to basketball for a moment, of The Last Dance. Which I finally got the chance to watch all the way through. Did you get a chance to finish it as well?
Yep, I finished it.
Yeah, so I was entertained, especially for nostalgia value. Like, you know, it was really great to kind of just kind of see all of these, you know, people again who once meant so much to me, and, you know, see what they look like now, and, you know, hear their insights and all that. But I also, you know, we talked a little bit about this off air, but I felt like the storytelling mechanism was a little bit awkward, the way it kept jumping through time, and like some points it made sense and some points it felt a little forced to me, the way that it was structured. And I listened to an interview with one of the guys. I'm not sure if his title would officially be director or producer or whatnot, but basically he was kind of in charge of splicing this thing together based on all the footage that they had. And he talked about the challenge of this, where they came to him, and, you know, I'm going to get my numbers jumbled here, so don't quote me on these numbers exactly, but essentially they were like, you know, we have this footage, we have this many hours, do you think you can make like a 12-hour, you know, series out of this? And his reaction was like, no, like there's just not enough here, it's going to be bad. Like, if you try to stretch this thing into like 12 episodes, it's not going to work. And then they offered him all this other kind of supplemental footage, where it was like, well, here, well, if we, what if it's not just the 97, 98 season, but also all this back channel of, you know, stuff from Jordan's college career, as well as earlier NBA seasons and yada, yada, yada. And he was like, okay, so I think if we tell the story this way, not linearly, but if we do all this jumping kind of stuff, I can make this into like a 10 episode series. And then it kind of went back and forth and compromised the number of episodes and all that. I think there was some funny moment where they settled on 8 episodes, and then the official press release went out and said 10. And he was like, what the hell? That's how I agree too. But, you know, it speaks to me a little bit. I mean, I don't know if Flashdance would have been better had it been shorter, had it been longer, anything. I mean, I just can't say because I don't know what they were working with exactly. But I do feel as though the fact that they had to contour it to whatever ESPN and Netflix needed is very different than the organic product it would have been of like, just make the best thing you can, however long that's going to be. Right.
Right.
That's a little bit of what the discussion is around money. You know, going back to this idea of, you know, you have to churn out 12 episodes a season for this show. And it's like, it'd be really good if we're only 10 episodes. Well, we need 12. Okay. So how am I going to stretch this out or add a filler episode that nobody really likes? Yeah, you know, to kind of make this thing work for those purposes.
And I see exactly what you're saying. And do you find that in writing too? In books, like do publishers often want like a certain or, you know, number of pages before?
So, I mean, there's all kinds of sort of default industry standards about like, these are the parameters for, you know, a full length book and especially, you know, a mainstream kind of, you know, major press kind of book. But like for a full length book, the general consensus is it's gotta be at least 40,000 words. But you're trying to publish like a novel with a mainstream publisher, that's way too short. Like it's gotta be more like 60,000-70,000 words. Unless you're doing some sort of like fantasy thing, in which case you're looking more like 100,000-150,000 words and so on and so forth down the line. I'm not an expert in any of those genres, but yeah, there is a sense to me, like for example, right now I've got a project that I'm shopping around that is around 20,000 words. And it's a very awkward space for it to operate in because it's not a full length book, at least by most conventional standards. It's long for what we termed a chapbook. Usually those are more like, you know, 15,000-ish words and often more geared towards poetry. So it's just sort of this in-between space. Like no magazine is going to publish it as its own thing because it's just, you know, just way too big to publish like that except for a very small handful of magazines. But it's like, you know, but do I really want to edit this thing down? Not really. Do I want to inflate it? Like I think the quality is going to get diluted if I inflate it too much more. But yeah. So
it sounds like it needs its own category.
Yeah.
And let the category be dictated by the work.
Yeah, and fortunately, we're in a moment where there's a greater diversity in terms of, you know, the written publishing. Like, if you're not trying to get rich off it, if you're not trying to publish with a big major house, there are places that will do stuff like that. Or I've now got a few different versions where one's a little shorter, one's a little longer, just depending on what the length guidelines are. So it's, you know, possible. But yeah, I think, you know, in terms of the intersection of, you know, media being kind of released to the world versus actual artistic merit, I think that there is a big divide there, and money is what determines these things, because the people who, you know, decide it's got to be 12 episodes or it's got to be 50,000 words are not the people who are, you know, creating things.
Right. Yeah. Interesting, huh?
Yeah. So a little bit of a tangent there for our listeners, but I hope you like our thoughts on all of that.
Yeah.
But yeah, to put up on The Wedding Singer, and then we'll get to, you know, Big Daddy into our last segments here. But so, you know, there's also the character of Glenn is the villain here. I forget the actor's name. Matthew Glaive. I might be mispronouncing that, but regardless, he's the villain here. And I think he does rate up there with Shooter in terms of, you know, top villains in Adam Sandler movies. He's such an over-the-top douche character again. So many of the reasons why we love Shooter, I think, are similar reasons why Glenn is kind of appealing here. And specifically, you know, there's so many moments throughout this thing where he's a jerk, but there's this moment where, you know, he rolls over in bed and, you know, just kind of assumes that Drew Barrymore's character has brought him breakfast in bed, and just where he's just, it's just so over the top of like, no, she's here to like talk to you. She's not here to like be your servant. But where it just, to me, really funny. And again, one of those characters where, because he's so over the top, like A, it's funny, but also B, it does feel really rewarding when he finally does kind of get his, you know, and Adam Sandler gets the last laugh on him in this movie. Mm-hmm. But other parts that, you know, stand out to you that you really like from this one?
No, you know, again, this movie is just a good movie throughout. I mean, I guess, you know, obviously there are those scenes that that stand out a little bit, but this is one of those movies that I actually don't have a ton of quotes that I often use from it, but rather I kind of just enjoy watching the movie as a whole and just, and although there is one part that that I think is kind of funny, going back to your Glenn thing, his last name is Guglia.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, obviously, again, typical Adam Sandler fashion, like, he makes a comment about it, like, oh, your name's going to be Julia Guglia. Yeah. And, you know, so it's just, and so that relationship wasn't meant to be anyway, you know,
right,
with Glenn. So, but it, you know, it's, again, it's, I really like the storyline. I think it was a good story, and it had, you know, comedy thrown in there, kind of like what you said. Yeah. It's got more of a plot, and then it with a little bit of comedy. So, yeah, definitely added that to my collection a while back. I actually have all these movies that we're talking about.
And I also like that. I mean, so Adam Sandler, I mean, there's no way you could, well, I guess, I don't know if he's a good singer. Like, I feel like the music he makes isn't built to show off his voice or anything. So, you know, maybe he's a good singer, but I don't think of him in that light necessarily, but he definitely does incorporate music into a lot of what he does. You know, you reference the albums that he recorded, you know, early in his career. And, you know, he's always had this part of his stand-up. That was a big part of his SNL persona. But this movie really brings that in. I think probably more than any other, you know, he's playing a wedding singer, so it makes sense that he's, you know, performing a number of times throughout this thing. But there's the song Love Stinks, which I think is sort of a pretty iconic part of the movie. Not necessarily my favorite by any stretch, but where he's, you know, doing the wedding singer gig not long after he was left at the altar. And he just kind of, you know, sings this raunchy song about how love stinks and gets all the other people to sing along with him until the father of the bride punches him out. So there's that piece of it. And then my favorite musical piece of this thing is definitely the end of it. Where they're on the plane and he sings the, you know, I Want to Grow Old With You song to Drew Barrymore's character. And, you know, that's just a sweet song. Like, you know, there's little, like, you know, bits of kind of humor and inside jokes from the movie kind of thrown in throughout it. But it's actually the kind of song I feel like you could just kind of listen to romantically and just sort of enjoy, right? And I think, you know, that's a part of, again, the heart of this movie is, you know, it is a comedy. It's got a lot of funny moments, some random stuff thrown in there. But it's maybe the truest love story of the Adam Sandler movies, or at least up until this point. And I think that song kind of drives that point home at the end of it. So any last thoughts on The Wedding Singer?
Yeah, no, I agree with that assessment. And regarding his musical talents and whatnot, like this is a perfect example of kind of popularity versus quality. And not to say that he's not a good singer. He might be, although I think with The Wedding Singer, I think they wanted the character to, even though he sings for a living, he was the wedding singer. Like, oddly enough, he's like, I think that he's like an okay singer,
right.
In the movie, you know, he kind of plays that kind of character. Like, yeah, I'm the guy who will sing at your wedding, but you're not going to get, you know, it's like, I'm not Whitney Houston. I'm not, you know, Frank Sinatra. I'm not, you know, I don't have like these amazing pipes, but I'm the guy who can kind of hold a note and I'm in the profession. So, you know, you can pay me to sing at your wedding. And I might go off the rails and do my own thing and get punched. But, but yeah, going back to his, kind of discography and those first few albums, you know, I mean, like, I feel like the Thanksgiving song, the Hanukkah song, like, I mean, this is more than 20 years later. And I feel like I still hear about them when the holidays come around.
Yeah.
And again, that's not going to win any awards, the music itself, but again, you know, it's popularity wise, you can't deny it. So,
no, you know, and that, I mean, this is, again, it's a little bit off topic of the movie, but I think it does speak to sort of, if you want to achieve immortality, like do something famous in an underexploited realm, you know, like,
yes.
How many Thanksgiving songs can people name? Like,
right.
There's Alice's Restaurant. I think is kind of the standard bearer, but then there's a Thanksgiving song by Adam Sandler. Like, I'm sure that there are other ones, but I don't know that I can name any other ones off the top of my head. And how many Hanukkah songs do you know? Like, Dreidel, Dreidel, Dreidel? Okay, but, right. like the Hanukkah song by Adam Sandler, like, that's the one that will actually get played on the radio. Like, that's the one that, you know, like, the people will, you know, kind of, you know, recognize, even if they don't like, they'll they kind of sing along to a little bit of it. So,
yep.
I think you're right, yeah.
And not only the you know, find the niche there or find the opportunity. But like, he not only did that, but he made it like funny too, like harmonica and, you know, actually harmonica is an actual word, but like he'd alter words just to make them like work with the song, even if it made
Seattle Supersonicas, for example.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. I don't know all the lyrics off the top of my head, but yeah. So I mean, it was like the perfect combination of factors, like you said, perhaps he was one of the first ones too. So if not the first, so you know, so yeah, it kind of makes sense why it's still popular.
Yeah. So I mean, yeah, finding that niche and like, and yeah, I think that's a big part of, you know, if we just, you know, look at that idea on a really macro scale, his success as an actor and as a movie maker, especially in the 90s, that there weren't people doing it, at least on this scale, at least with this kind of, you know, level of success that he was achieving. And so carved out that kind of little, you know, place for himself in American pop culture. All right, so let's switch gears to Big Daddy, the last of the four films that we earmarked for this show. So this one, the premise, it's a little bit more plot driven, like sort of similar to what we were saying about Wedding Singer, where it's not just sort of, you know, random jokes, but, you know, the premise here that Adam Sandler comes upon this kid who, you know, I think it's set up that it's his roommate's actual kid that he didn't know about, and the mom passes away, and so she sends him to live with him. So some pretty serious plot holes there, but regardless, you know, Adam Sandler finds himself kind of, you know, taking care of this kid for a period of, I think it's roughly weeks, maybe months, and kind of, you know, developing a relationship with the kid and kind of being a real parental figure and kind of growing through the process, only to, you know, have the kid kind of taken more legitimately when, you know, the system kind of picks up that, you know, he has this kid he really shouldn't have. And I think that that's one of the interesting things about Big Daddy is in all of the other Adam Sandler movies that we've talked about, there's a more cut and dry, there's a villain who, you know, is kind of trying to do something unethical. Adam Sandler might not be perfect, but nonetheless, he's clearly the good guy in this scenario. It's a lot grayer in Big Daddy, you know, especially, you know, we're both parents now, like have a little different perspective on this kind of stuff now. You know, if one of our random friends just got a kid and decided, oh yeah, I'll keep the kid and take care of him. Like, you know, I think it, as it's presented in the movie, that seems, you know, defensible and it seems entertaining, but in real life, it's like, no, that's not safe. That's not right. Like, he shouldn't have that kid. it's a little bit itchy how conflicted that sort of is. And they don't get super deep on all that, but I think it is sort of baked into the movie. But with all that said, though, I did want to just kind of, you know, throw it out there. You know, what stands out to you from this movie? You know, what do you like best? You know, quotes, moments, anything along those lines?
Well, you know, let me first say that, you know, you had mentioned earlier about the other Adam Sandler movies, and how their titles were kind of very descriptive of the character, and you know, in kind of a way, this is the same. And we have Billy Madison, we have Happy Gilmore, you know, the Wedding Singer. He was the Wedding Singer. Big Daddy. I mean, he's the daddy, I guess, figure. I mean, it's kind of like a heartwarming film, and especially relative to some of his other ones. So I really enjoyed it, and so, you know, while it may not be 100% realistic, you know, I can relate to some of the things that he experienced as kind of the kid's de facto father, father figure. And you know, like there was that scene in McDonald's where, you know, the guy, like another customer, like questions his parenting skills or something, because the kid is, is the kid screaming, I think, or something.
Yeah.
And you know, in true Adam Sandler fashion, he's like, take a hike, and he throws the other customer's fries on the floor, because the guy was like, yeah, nice parenting, you know, and I just feel like we've all been there, you know, it's just like, And so, and again, it's there. Go ahead. What were you going to say?
Well, no, if I can kind of do with the McDonald's thing, because I think I absolutely get what you're saying. I think that that is relatable, just sort of that frustration, especially when you're already kind of frustrated and someone's sort of judging you. And it's like, well, screw this. I'm just going to, you know, do my thing. But funnily enough, like on another level, the whole McDonald's thing, like, you know, the whole premise of them going there is like, hey, we can actually get there in time for breakfast. I'm never awake in time for that because the kid gets up early. So, you know, they go there. And, you know, and this is more of a personal note, but I think I'm not the only one where, you know, you know me. Anyone who's known me for a long time, you know, knows that traditionally I'm not a morning person. Like, mm-hmm. Left to my own devices is not unusual for, you know, that I would, like, you know, stay up until like 2 a.m. and then sleep until like 10, 11, noon, you know, whatever it might be. So that premise that you just wouldn't be up in time for a McDonald's breakfast, I totally get that. And on the flip side of that, since I've had my son, you know, now it's, you know, been a little over 2.5 years as of recording this, I've had a total reversal where now I fairly routinely actually get up at like 5:30 in the morning, just so I can get some work done before my son's up. And then, you know, we can, you know, have some time together. You know, so the way the kids kind of change you and that kind of practical thing where it's like, I never would have thought to ask for this. And, you know, it's just sort of alien if you don't have kids and if you aren't a morning person and all that. But how a kid kind of just shifts that where it's like, oh, all right, we're up in time. I guess we might as well do this thing that like now the idea of being up by, you know, whatever, 10 a.m. to get a McDonald's breakfast is like, well, yeah, obviously I'm going to be up. I've been up for 5 hours already.
Completely doable.
Yeah.
Yeah. And actually,
I didn't know, but I didn't mean to cut you off there. Yeah. I don't know anything else you were going to say on that.
No. It's just that it's again, very relatable. And it does, I mean, and more so than, it has been, like you said, you know, now that we're both parents, I think we approach this movie with a different perspective.
Yeah.
So how about yourself? What are some of your, kind of highlights or favorite, scenes or moments?
Yeah. Well, yeah, you know, which is one other piece I'll daze to, you know, we're kind of on a similar note there, kind of being relatable, the whole kangaroo song thing. So, you know, the kid has the kangaroo song, they have a VHS tape of, which is, again, we're talking 90s nostalgia, that fits pretty well in that discussion, but he likes to watch this tape every time he wakes up from a nap, I think is the gist of his routine. But he wakes up from a nap, you know, right in like a pivotal point of this hockey game Adam Sandler's trying to watch. And so he just keeps screaming for the song until Adam Sandler gives in, even though it's a really exciting game. And then it's just a super hokey thing where a kangaroo is jumping around and the kids jump around with him and singing the song. You know, and again, it's the kind of thing where, I mean, there's obvious humor there and there's sort of an obvious, like, you know, we all know kids are kind of into that sort of thing. But now there are certain, you know, video songs I've listened to, you know, it's gotta be like hundreds of times, if not thousands of times, that I would never listen to in my regular life that, you know, now it's just a part of the routine. It's like, yep, we're going to listen to that Animal Farm song again. That's what we do at this point in the day.
Yep. So. Yep. well, and not to just keep it going, but I'm going to keep it going. Like there's, you know, remember Scuba Steve?
Yeah.
You know, like stepping on something on the floor that you just,
yeah,
you know, like generally speaking, before you have kids, your floors, again, generally don't have just random toys strewn across it,
mm-hmm.
Or across them. And, but yeah, I mean, like if you haven't stepped on a Lego, mm-hmm. or some sort of toy or puzzle or something, then you, you know, and you're a parent, then eventually you will. And then, and in a weird way, one thing I can relate, see, it's really like this kind of coming together of, you know, like, I mean, he's like this, he's just a bachelor, right? I mean, mm-hmm. living his life, and then a kid comes into it. And, you know, again, I haven't gone to these levels, but I get it. You know, when there's a spill or something, like he finds the closest newspaper and just, I mean, oh, that's no problem. Spilled milk. No, just take the sports section and cover it up. I mean, it's like, if I try that these days, it just doesn't work. I mean, my wife, you know.
No, you're right. It's like an exaggeration of a dynamic that I think all of us have something like, you know, where it's like, yeah, you know, when there's a total mess on the living room floor, my instinct still is just, let me just scoop up all of these toys and crap and just throw them in different boxes and call it a day. Or whereas my wife will come in and be like, well, no, like this is the box for the foam tiles. This is the box for the musical instruments. This is the box for the kitchen stuff, you know? And it's like, okay, we're going to take this much time, but you know, I mean, practically speaking, it's the right thing to do, I think. But yeah, it's kind of, you know, again, the just dropping a newspaper over some spilled milk, that's obviously way over the top, but that dynamic though, of like, let's just solve this in a way that kind of takes care of the immediate problem and leave it. Yeah, it's totally relatable on that, that level.
Yeah.
But yeah. And, you know, otherwise, I mean, I think part of what I like about this movie is, you know, I think the kid stuff is good. It's heartwarming. And there's a lot of funny moments there. But I think there are also, moments here that are really funny that have nothing to do directly with the kid. So there's that whole part at the beginning where they're throwing a surprise party. And, you know, Adam Sandler's character walks in. And Leslie Mann's character, you know, has this whole bit. She's probably about as close as there is to a villain in this movie, because she just has an antagonistic relationship with Sandler. But you know, she's so disappointed because they wasted the good surprise on him. Like they all like yelled surprise, and it was only him, not the person the party was for. And then I think it's John Stewart, who the party was supposed to be for, walks in, and they're all just kind of like, "Oh, hey, surprise! Yeah, okay." And she's like, "We wasted the good surprise on you." I still quote that whenever there's an opportunity to do so. Like the other day, I used the wrong spaghetti sauce because it was like the one with extra vegetables we use for my son. And my wife, you know, got a little miffed at me, and I was like, "We wasted the good sauce on you." And like, I don't know, maybe I'm just a terrible person. But
how did she take that, Mike?
She didn't love it. I'll be honest with you.
Was that also the scene where, not too long after I think one guy was going to propose to the other, and he was like, "Hey, you're not going to propose, are you?"
Yeah, yeah.
And he was like, "Yeah, I actually was. You wanna?"
Yeah. I think that is right. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's there's never a shortage of humor, kind of, you know, infused into Adam Sandler movies.
And I think that's where this overlaps with, you know, especially with Wedding Singer, but I think with the other movies too, where I think you're exactly right. I mean, there's more of a plot here, and there's more like, you know, family-friendly kind of heartwarming stuff kind of embedded in it. But there still are just those throwaway, you know, kind of random juvenile jokes that he squeezes in there that still, you know, let you know this is still an Adam Sandler movie.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. But speaking of that, I mean, and you know, this is kind of bridging the gap where, because it involves the kid, but it's more a moment for Rob Schneider to shine as kind of Adam Sandler's sidekick, as he is in a lot of movies. But where they're, you know, practicing how to read, and he's the delivery man who doesn't really know how to read, it becomes clear. And they're both, you know, looking at words, and he's trying to read the word hippopotamus, and he pronounces it hip hop anonymous, and gets all frustrated because he's getting the hard ones and the kid's getting the easy ones. I think it's just another like really funny moment here where you know, it underscores how similar to children Adam Sandler and his friends are in this moment, and how much he kind of grows up, you know, over the course of this movie.
And as far as Rob Schneider goes, I'm trying to remember what he had been in up to this point. This wasn't one of his was it like the peak of his career?
He went on to do like the Deuce Bigelow, Male Gigolo stuff, and like, oh, right, like other things. But I think movies like this, I know he was in Wedding Singer as just kind of a bit part. And I think he's in some of the other earlier Adam Sandler movies as well, and definitely a lot of later ones. I know Waterboy he's pretty prominently in. But I think his kind of claim to fame is sort of riding Adam Sandler's coattails, for lack of a better thing. He's sort of like the poor man's Adam Sandler. So he's in a lot of, you know, Adam Sandler movies. He got a little run of getting movies of his own kind of based on the success of those movies. I don't think any of them really took off on nearly the level that any of the Adam Sandler movies did. So I think he kind of settled back into that role as kind of just one of Sandler's guys. At least that's how I think of him. Maybe there's some hardcore Rob Schneider fans out there who will, you know, what way in here and correct me, but yeah, I think that's about where his career went.
Gotcha.
But yeah, in terms of, you know, other, you know, bits of this movie, I mean, the whole courtroom scene, I think is, you know, it's really where we kind of get the nexus of, you know, a dramatic movie and kind of one of the more serious scenes of one of these early Adam Sandler movies, with also having some silliness embedded in there with the different witnesses and the way that they act on the stand. So, you know, I think that's a fun part to watch. And again, kind of a cross-section of the different things Adam Sandler movies were doing at that point. There's a montage that I really like where they're playing Sweet Child of Mine. It's the Sheryl Crow version that I think was I'm not sure if it was recorded for the purpose of this movie and soundtrack, but I think that's where it got its biggest acclaim, and that's where it, you know, is recognized from. And I think that's just, to me, I just really like it as a montage. You know, it kind of centers the focus on, you know, he's trying to be a more parental figure and think about the kid. He's actually applying himself and working hard because he, you know, went to law school but never, you know, actually, you know, did anything with it. And I just really like that part of the movie as a rare moment that's not really at all comedic in the movie, right? But I think still has a good heart to it. Anything else from Big Daddy that you were thinking about?
I mean, there's definitely a few other memorable moments. There's obviously, if you look at the cover of the VHS at the time, it's Adam Sandler and the child are, you know, like peeing on a building, you know, and again, I can't say that I wasn't that kid with my dad at one point. I mean, it's sure, just, sure. You know, it's 30 years ago, and it's just, again, I kind of get it, even though I don't endorse, you know, peeing on buildings, but yeah. But you know, it's a very father son type of moment that I think they're trying to, you know, convey. And kind of similar to what you were saying before, you know, there's this father son dynamic kind of coupled with, you know, Adam Sandler's experience as just being kind of a bachelor, kind of goofy and whatnot. And, you know, his idea of quality time with the kid involves throwing sticks into a road or whatever, where there's skaters so that they trip over them. I mean, it's like the kid finds it funny, because what kid wouldn't find, you know, something like that funny? And obviously Adam Sandler does too. And so it's just, I think that's why this movie works. You know, it appeals to the people who like comedies and not like raunchy comedies. And it does have that plot and storyline, and relatable, you know, parent child dynamic. So yeah, and frankly, I remember after having seen it, I actually distinctly remember wanting to have my parents watch it with me. Hmm. It's kind of weird. Like growing up, I remember like as a small child, we would do like family movie nights, and I remember watching like Uncle Buck with my parents and all that stuff. And you know, by 99, when this came out, you know, I was in my teenage years. So like we hadn't really done that anymore. It just wasn't a thing. Yet this was one that I thought they would kind of like, or they would find some things to like about. So, actually it was probably the last movie that I like pushed to have to watch as like a family. Hmm. After that point, it was just like, I went to the movies, you know, with my own friends or whatever, or whatever, but we just, you know, we didn't all get into the living room and watch a movie together. So yeah, that's,
I think you're exactly right. That it's the kind of movie that, you know, there is enough kind of, you know, silly kind of juvenile humor that it will appeal to a teenager or younger kind of person. But there is also that family element of where, you know, I haven't, to be completely transparent, haven't watched this movie probably in the last, I don't know, you know, at least 15 years, you know, probably more than that even at this point. But I kind of want to, you know, it doesn't sound sort of like this would be kind of dumb. I, you know, like a lot of movies I liked in that part of my life, it's like, yeah, you know, it's maybe fun for nostalgia purposes alone, but it's not really, you know, enjoyable now. I think that one probably would hold up. But yeah, you know, just to put a bow on it, you know, you were talking about, you know, things like, you know, peeing on the building or, you know, making kind of juvenile jokes in front of a kid or whatnot, you know, and it's the kind of thing where I think it's so relatable because a lot of us have those moments, but they're not the moments we're proud of, you know, like when I post stuff to like Facebook of, you know, my son, you know, it's us in front of like, you know, some pretty scenery or him doing something cool that he's done for the first time or, you know, things along those lines. you know, it's not when, you know, we have to, you know, go use the bathroom in some awkward place, or, you know, when I make some joke I probably shouldn't be making in front of him, but he still doesn't have language to really understand it, so it's okay. Like, you know, these moments that, you know, yeah, we aren't necessarily proud of, we wouldn't necessarily harken back to, but a lot of us have them, you know, that, I think that's what makes it so relatable. Mm-hmm. But all right, well, let's go ahead and transition to our last couple of segments here. So, you know, each episode we ask, you know, would it work today, or how has it aged? So the first thing I wanted to touch on here was kind of the style of humor. I mean, we've talked about this a lot, you know, over the course of the episode. But, you know, he has kind of this signature, you know, juvenile sense of humor, kind of gross out humor, especially in the earlier movies. You know, and it still bleeds over in kind of at least being kind of absurdist in his later movies, if not kind of as over the top, you know, offensive or, you know, foul language or anything like that. But yeah, in terms of, you know, the kind of humor that Adam Sandler uses, you know, what do you think about that?
I feel like it's such a broad spectrum. I don't know why, but I feel like he has some pretty raunchy humor, and then he has some that's like a little just more like silly. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I guess I'm not sure where I stand on it. What do you think?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where, I mean, especially for nostalgia purposes, I'll still, you know, pop in an old Adam Sandler movie every now and again, you know, and still find it funny. But I think in terms of, you know, if we were to transition that to today and say that he had never, you know, been a celebrity before, and this is the very first that we're seeing of him, I do question how well at least some of it would hold up now, in part just because I think it's a style of humor that was popular in that era, you know, or that we hadn't really seen as much of, but now we have. And I was trying to find the name of it, but yeah, I don't see it offhand, but he had this Netflix special that came out. It was just mostly him doing stand-up comedy. This was about, I think, like 2 years ago or so. I watched it kind of, you know, in part just because, like, well, I remember how funny he used to be, how much I used to like him. I wonder, you know, how this will be. And I didn't find it that funny. You know, and it was a lot of songs, and it was a lot of like little stand-up bits and all that. I think it just had not aged that well, you know, because he, like, for example, he had a song that I remember, it was UFC Ears, where he was just kind of making fun of guys who do like jujitsu and MMA and end up with those cauliflower ears that you tend to get. And he's like, he's, you know, a really tough guy, except he's got those UFC ears. And it's like, I mean, I get the joke. It's, I guess it's kind of funny, but it's also just, it's just kind of juvenile. But like, really, we're just going to talk about this guy's ears for a 3-minute song. Like, yeah, you know, it feels a little bit tired in that way. You know, but he did have one, the only part special I really liked, the part that stuck with me, and the part that I've rewatched a few times, is he has a tribute song to Chris Farley on there, where he just talks about their friendship and, you know, what was unique about him. That I just think is really good, and that I think, you know, works as a standalone thing. And, you know, for people who are interested, you can find that on YouTube. It's like a 5-minute clip in and of itself. But I think overall the humor itself, like, you had to have already been a fan to sit through this thing. Like, you're not going to just kind of watch this on its own and find it that funny, I don't think.
And is this the 100% fresh? Is that the one?
Yeah, that sounds right. Yeah, I think that's right. And it wasn't that fresh.
No. Yeah, interesting. You know, and I guess, you know, that does make a lot of sense. And you know, and perhaps that's why, you know, if we look at some of his more recent movies, right, like Uncut Gems, not really a comedy at all.
Well, yeah, I want to get into that. But yeah, I'll finish your thought there. Yeah.
So, you know, but yeah, I actually have to agree with that assessment. You know, if I didn't know who Adam Sandler was and understand his comedy from, you know, our adolescent years and whatnot, then I probably, I don't know that I would have the same, what's the word? Affliction?
Connection to it, maybe.
Connection, yeah. So yeah, that was a good assessment.
Yeah, well, no, and that's the thing I want to say about, you know, some of his more recent actual movies, because he has a deal with Netflix now where he just rolls them out multiple a year. You know, and I have not watched most of them, so I can't really speak in an educated way about them. But, you know, I watched the first Grown Ups movie, for example, which that one was not a Netflix one. That was an actual, you know, major motion picture. And it had a really strong cast of a lot of the same, you know, people he worked with a lot in the 90s. And I just didn't think it was good at all. And the thing of it was that I think it was almost, they weren't even really trying anymore. So it was just bringing together this cast of people and hope that it's funny. And, you know, and people like you and me might watch it just on the premise of like, well, all these people are in it. So sure, I'll give it a shot. You know, from what I've kind of informally heard, he actually has kind of made the transition, like with the Grown Ups movies. I only watched the first one, but my understanding is that for each of them, they go to some location that's part of the premise. It's like a reunion in some like island or something like that. You know, but it actually literally they're kind of just milking it, because it's like, okay, you're going to pay for us to go to Hawaii and stay for, you know, a month, and we'll do some funny stuff and we'll record it and we're going to call it a movie. But it's essentially a paid vacation with his buddies. It's kind of how he takes it, which is really smart if you can get away with it. So I don't actually begrudge Adam Sandler that whole premise. But you know, I think in terms of movie quality, it doesn't exactly invite, you know, the best movies in. But yeah, but you mentioned Uncut Gems, which actually is an example I wanted to zero in on, because I think it is a break from most of what he's done. He does have a few other dramas under his belt, but I think that's the one that, you know, actually got some awards buzz, and, you know, people were talking about it as a more serious film. And, you know, as I was watching it, I liked it. Like, I'm not gonna say it was one of my favorite movies, but, you know, I did enjoy it. It has a really strong basketball tie-in with Kevin Garnett, and, you know, they built up the drama of one of the games really, really well. But I think the reason that film works, or what's at stake in that movie, is it's actually just sort of an updated version of what an Adam Sandler movie always has been. I'm not going to spoil too much for folks who might not have seen it. We're focused on 90s nostalgia, so we'll spoil stuff from the 90s. You've had, you know, 20, 30 years to catch up on that. Uncut Gems only came out last year, so you haven't had nearly as much time for that one. But nonetheless, though, you know, the premise of it being just kind of this doofus who's in over his head, and he has a wife who's kind of out of his league, and he just keeps getting himself into trouble and getting frustrated, like, that's basically an Adam Sandler movie. Like it's just kind of pitched in a dramatic way, as opposed to a more silly the way he would have done in the 90s. So I think to the extent that film works, it's largely based on that same premise. And I think it was probably a good call to take it in a dramatic route, because at least that was different for him. And I think fits a little bit more with kind of the modern aesthetic around movies. But I think you said you saw that movie as well. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I did see it. And, I hadn't looked at it through that lens, but you're absolutely right. It really is kind of another Adam Sandler movie, just with a dramatic spin. And I too like the tie to the NBA, and specifically Kevin Garnett in that game.
Yeah,
yeah, it was really kind of cool. But I think if I'm not mistaken, he has a few more movies coming out of a similar ilk.
That might be, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think that we're going to probably see a little bit more of that. And it probably does kind of jive better with today's, like society today than what's one of his earlier types of movies.
Yeah. You know, and it's the thing where I think it'll be interesting to see what happens in terms of, you know, I don't think anyone has really taken him that seriously as an actor throughout his career. And I think that's fair. Like, I never went to see an Adam Sandler movie on the premise of, oh, he's such a skilled thespian. Like, I've got to see him perform. You know, it's always been like, this will probably be pretty funny. You know, with the exception of Uncut Gems, I already heard the buzz about that being more serious, but, you know, before I got into it. But to see if he really does have these acting chops. Like, I think he was good in Uncut Gems. I think the people who are calling that he should have gotten an Oscar nomination are overselling it a little bit. I'm not sure I really say that he, you know, deserves that kind of a claim. But to see if he does hold up as a dramatic actor, and if he does have more chops there, I'd be interested to see that.
Well, and it's funny, because even before we started brainstorming, you know, like this podcast and what, you know, what movies we would focus on for this Adam Sandler episode, you know, I've always thought of him as kind of a mediocre actor. But I could never understand why he was so wealthy. Like, if you look up his net worth,
yeah,
it's somewhere near $500 million.
Yeah.
And I just, like, it's still kind of a mystery to me that somebody who, I mean, he's been in a lot of different movies, oftentimes plays a similar type of character. Usually, you know, these are movies that are not going to win Oscars. You know, it's just, I just think it's kind of funny. Like, I applaud him, like, good for him for still being relevant, you know, 20, 30 years later, you know, still getting movies, still, you know, having that kind of popularity and whatnot. And it's just, and again, good for him for accumulating so much wealth, in doing so. So,
well, and there was that whole, I don't know enough about this off the top of my head to really speak very intelligently, so I'll just touch upon it, and maybe you know more. But there was that whole scandal a couple years back, where maybe it was a year back, I don't even know, but where a bunch of emails from, you know, movie studio executives leaked, you know, and it was revealed that they kind of had to say the same perception, where they called him, like, the idiot. And they were very disrespectful to, like, to him and his movies, but were like, all right, so what are we going to do with the idiot this year? Like, we need to, you know, he's going to bring in like $10 million or whatever. So let's, you know, put him in something. Like, what should we do? You know, and I think that, you know, when they leaked, he saw it. I think that might be a part of why he moved away from kind of more major Hollywood to the deal with Netflix, is to, you know, kind of, you know, get back at them, or to have, you know, more self-respect about it or whatnot. But yeah, you know, I think that the world at large doesn't necessarily think of him as being, you know, the super talented guy as much as this guy who, you know, connected with a specific audience in a specific time, and, you know, has been able to ride that out and, you know, make millions of dollars for himself and, you know, and for everyone kind of affiliated with him. But yeah, and I should make just a brief aside here, just because, you know, I don't like to make this kind of a show about, you know, contemporary social issues or whatnot, but, you know, there was also stuff that came out about some not so great treatment of women in Adam Sandler's past. In particular, there was some implication that he made women come in to audition for parts wearing a two-piece bathing suit or wearing their underwear, and like, and not even a way that was like, well, there's going to be a scene with this, so it's relevant, but more of just like kind of a sexist like power play, essentially, that he could, you know, get to see them in their underwear. So, you know, not a great look for him. Not to say that he's the best human being. I don't know enough about him. You know, I've never met the guy. I don't know people who know him to really have an educated opinion about all that. But just to acknowledge it for anyone who thinks we're just kind of celebrating him and thinking he's wonderful or anything like that. No, if anything, I think we're kind of acknowledging that he's sort of problematic, and his art, so such as it is, isn't that artistic in most cases. But nonetheless, just kind of has a special place for us, you know, again, especially nostalgically speaking.
Right. Yep.
But yeah, well, let's go ahead to our final segment here, which is the draft. So I had some fun putting this one together. To review for, you know, listeners who maybe haven't tuned into our previous episodes, you know, with our NBA episode, we looked at, you know, just kind of drafting our own starting lineups based on stars of the 1990s. For our American Pie one, we kind of brainstormed, you know, putting together a little movie marathon to pair with the American Pie movies. And then for our wrestling one, we assembled, you know, teams for a Survivor Series style event. So in this one, the premise that we concocted was, you're going to assemble our own cast for an Adam Sandler movie. I assembled sort of a bank of actors and actresses who were featured in the four films that we were talking about. I'm fine with going beyond, you know, those four films as well. So Mike, if you have other people in mind from other movies, feel free to, you know, draft them in as well. But I put them in three categories, and obviously, you know, Adam Sandler movies, they typically have, I don't even know how many people, but I'm sure a cast of at least, you know, probably 10 to 15, you know, significant characters where you'll have names or, you know, roles that we could recognize. So you know, this is way oversimplifying it, but drafting a core cast of three people to kind of group around Adam Sandler, and the three categories I've given us to each draft one person to be a part of this kind of dream movie scenario, one love interest for him. So, you know, from the movies we saw, there's Joey Lauren Adams from Big Daddy, there's Drew Barrymore from Wedding Singer, Julie Bowen from Happy Gilmore, and Bridget Wilson Sampras from Billy Madison. Drew Barrymore's been in, you know, multiple Adam Sandler movies at this point, so you know, beyond the 90s, but there's been some other people, you know, Idina Menzel, you could now kind of count her as an Adam Sandler love interest in movies based on her role in Uncut Gems. So in any event, you know, a wide cast we could pull from. For villains, I just pulled the three from the movies we were talking about of, you know, Bradley Whitford from Billy Madison, Christopher McDonald from Happy Gilmore, Shooter McGavin, and Matthew Glaive from The Wedding Singer. And then I'm not going to run through the full list here just because it's really all over the place. But so we have love interest, we have villain. Each of the movies has something like that. And then just one eccentric friend. Because that's kind of a hallmark of Adam Sandler movies is there are always these friend characters who are a little bit odd, who have, you know, something, you know, weird going on with them, or has come in for a very specific kind of comedy relief, you know, often with, you know, relatively limited minutes in the movie. Like they aren't necessarily, you know, featured, you know, as consistently as Sandler or the love interest. You might only get, you know, 15, 20 minutes in the movie, but might give us the most memorable moments of the movie with that limited time. So, you know, a cast of folks from the 90s that I kind of, you know, brainstormed for us. One that I'll address, I don't think either one of us are actually going to pick them. So I'm just going to mention them now because we didn't talk about them in Big Daddy. Cole and Dylan Sprouse, who are the twins who split up the kid role in Big Daddy, which, for people like me who watch Riverdale, we now know Cole Sprouse has gone on to become kind of a teen heartthrob. And it's sort of a bizarre to watch him, you know, grow up from that little kid to that kind of role. But anyway, just to make mention of, he's in play if one of us did want to kind of get wacky and pick him again. Just one pick from each category. I don't think he's going to show up on the draft board, but I'll make mention of him. But yeah, Mike, anything you want to say before we get into making our picks here?
No, let's do it.
All right. So I'll go ahead. I'll give you the first pick here. So you can pick from any category you want. Who's your first pick for you to group with Adam Sandler in one of these movies?
I think I have to go with Julie Bowen.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Yeah, for the love interest. Yeah, I don't know. I just I really enjoyed her role with Adam Sandler in Happy Gilmore. I think she's a really great actress. You can see that with a lot of the Adam Sandler movies, yeah, there's always a love interest, and I for whatever reason, I just really like the dynamic of those two, and the other thing I really like too is that they're both very much still like relevant so many years later. So like legitimately it could happen. Probably could happen with any of these actresses, but it's still, I don't know. I think Julie Bowen, I think her career has definitely blossomed since then. Yeah.
She's a really good comedic actress and I think, you know, Modern Family in particular, I think kind of, you know, put her on a lot of people's radar, long after this film. But yeah, I think she's a solid pick for, that. And she's actually, I was kind of eyeing her. So I had two picks in mind for love interest. She was going to be kind of my sleeper pick, who I wasn't as sure would kind of get any play here. So I'm going to hold on that, though, because now that you've picked a love interest, now I'm safe to get my other pick. So I'll wait on that category for my first pick. I'm going to go straight to Chris Farley for my eccentric friend pick. So Farley, he's an interesting choice for this category because he's not someone who was a regular who appeared in a lot of the Adam Sandler movies. Like Rob Schneider, Steve Buscemi, or Norm Macdonald, they were all in, you know, several of them. To my knowledge, I'm probably missing something, but off the top of my head, I think he was only in Billy Madison, at least of, you know, the major ones that starred Adam Sandler. Just in terms of, you know, a comedic actor who, really delivered, who I think, you know, can carry as much of a movie as you want. I think if you want to put him on equal footing with Adam Sandler and have them kind of co-star in a movie, that'd be a totally viable choice. He had his own starring roles, you know, Tommy Boy and Black Sheep and things like that. I think they had good chemistry. So he's going to be my top pick, just to plug into whatever eccentric friend role we might need for this movie.
Oh, that's very interesting. I like the analysis though. I'll go on the flip side of that. So sticking with that category, mm-hmm. I have to go with Steve Buscemi,
yeah.
who I think has been in all of the movies that we discussed, or the four main ones. Let's see, we did Happy Gilmore, Billy Madison. Oh wait, was he in Happy Gilmore?
That's okay. I don't know if he was in Happy Gilmore because he was definitely in all the other three. And in the one too.
Yeah, so in Wedding Singer is the best man. He was an eccentric friend. I don't know.
We're taking the friend part pretty broadly there.
Yeah, okay, yeah. But Billy Madison, you know, he was the guy who crossed Billy's name off the list of people Big Daddy, he was the homeless guy.
Yeah.
I think he was in Mr. Deeds too.
Yeah, this is Crazy Eyes. If
you yeah, Crazy Eyes. That's right. And so, yeah, he seems to be just making an appearance in a vast majority of Adam Sandler's movies. And again, I mean, I can't say more than just the fact that I mean, I really like Steve Buscemi as an actor, separate from this, but it's just, you know, he just plays that eccentric friend role so well. Yeah. I mean, it's like one of them, it's called his name's Crazy Eyes. I mean, like, and it's not actually his name, but it's just, you know, he's never playing just like the boring old friend, you know, right. He's the guy that's going to kill Billy Madison, you know, like that was going to kill him before Billy apologized to him, you know? So, I would probably pick him.
Yeah.
He's got a good track.
I think he's a solid choice. Yeah. So at this point, we both still need villains. So you've picked your love interest, your eccentric. I picked just my eccentric friend. So I'm going to jump to the villain category just because I want to make sure I get someone I want here. But I don't think this is going to be the person you would have picked. I actually think this might have been the last person on your list. I'm going to pick Bradley Whitford, who appeared in Billy Madison as kind of the guy who's trying to steal the company. And the reasoning for that, I actually think, you know, of our choices, he might be the weakest in the actual film. I think he might be the least funny in that kind of villain role. Not to discredit Whitford's performance there, but just in terms of relative to Shooter McGavin and, you know, and Glenn Gulia in The Wedding Singer, I think that they're just more over the top kind of, you know, douchebag characters who it's easy to hate. Bradley Whitford, he played a starring role on The West Wing, which ran for, I think it was 7 full years. And I just love his part in that. You know, I had watched the first couple seasons of that in real time when it aired, then I went off to college and kind of lost track of it. I went back and rewatched the whole thing just in the last couple years and just kind of really, you know, fell in love with the show. And, you know, everyone talks about, you know, Aaron Sorkin's writing on that show and, you know, Martin Sheen's performance as the president. There's a really good cast all around on that show. But Bradley Whitford is kind of the character I most resonated with. He's just this incredibly diligent, kind of sharp, kind of mean and cranky sometimes guy who I just find so sort of attractive as a character. You know, the villain role, it's almost hard for me to see him in that role anymore because I so associate him with the Josh Lyman character from West Wing at this point. But I think he's a really talented actor, and I think he could rise to the occasion of playing, you know, whatever part was needed for him if he were ever willing to do an Adam Sandler movie again, which I'm kind of skeptical that he would, but I think he would, you know, really deliver in that kind of role.
So do you think your view or your choice would change if you hadn't seen him in The West Wing? And
well, 100%. Yeah, I don't think he would rank in the conversation for me. I don't want to spoil what you would say, and I don't want to talk over your analysis of characters. I might weigh in with, you know, whoever you end up picking with your selection. But I think in terms of just the movies in isolation, that the other two that we have on the board are probably more obvious choices. But yeah, I think just having seen, you know, a broader spectrum of his work, and especially West Wing, that's what makes me, you know, so solidly behind Bradley Whitford.
Gotcha. And frankly, I mean, if we want to talk about, you know, broad spectrum of work, you know, Christopher McDonald and Matthew Glaive, I'm hard pressed to think of other movies that they've been in, or many other movies.
I know Chris McDonald had a relatively serious career before this point. Matthew Glaive, I'm not as familiar with. I don't know how much career he had.
Right. So I can't draw a lot from that. But I guess who I'll choose is Christopher McDonald.
Yeah.
And like you said, it is probably the more obvious choice in that. You know, villainous or whatever relationship was very strong all throughout Happy Gilmore. And, you know, I can't say much about Christopher McDonald as an actor. I mean, I don't think he's particularly great personally, but he does play the villain really well in Happy Gilmore. I think there's a lot of, you know, banter back and forth. And I think that, and I had mentioned earlier that, you know, he had gone to college kind of close by me. Mm-hmm. So like, he gets a few points for that reason.
Sure.
you know, and Matthew Glaive, you know, it's just, you know, again, that's that he comes from the movie that has a little bit more of a plot to it and not incredibly overt, you know, comebacks and, you know, and again, villainous relationships kind of so much so as Happy Gilmore and Billy Madison have. So, so yeah, I have to go with Shooter McGavin. And any time I'm playing mini golf or anything like that, like I'm sure to quote something from that movie or something.
You do
that
the little shooter thing with your hand.
Yeah, exactly. You exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. yeah, don't judge me.
I do it too. I don't judge him.
Yeah. I you can be sure I do not do the Matthew Glaive thing with my wife. Like anytime she comes in the room, I do not say like, "Oh, you brought me breakfast in bed."
Yeah, I still throw that in every now and again.
No, see, I cherish my marriage, and I just want to make sure it.
I think you gotta keep it spicy, though. You gotta.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Well, fire alive.
That's true. Yeah. So we'll be doing this the next round or set of. You know, four episodes or so another time when we're back to being bachelors.
Yeah, but I'll be in my studio apartment. And
yeah. Yeah, I'll be on my couch. It'll be...
Yeah.
Yep. So, but yeah, so I think that covers it. I had Julie Bowen from Happy Gilmore, Chris McDonald from Happy Gilmore, and then Steve Buscemi, who I don't think we've determined his name.
It's funny because I was going to say, well, you could kind of just do Happy Gilmore again. And then I realized, yeah, that you picked the one actor or the one movie that actor didn't appear in, I think.
Yep. Yep. So it's...
But it probably would be better, though. I mean, we could probably throw in Steve Buscemi in some random role in that movie. I don't think it would hurt things. So I think that's a really sound pick.
Thank you. I think he could have been the, you know, the guy who was like, and you can count on me waiting for in the parking lot.
Yeah, you know, if we took out the giant aspect of him and made him like just like a crazy guy, he could have played that part. Or I think he could have been the Red Lobster guy.
Maybe the Red Lobster guy. Yeah, who was that guy anyway? Like nobody.
I feel like that's actually a name actor. I feel like we probably should know that, but I can't think of it off the top of my head. So. All right. Well, so for my last pick, I think it's crazy I'm able to steal her with the last pick, but this is the benefit of just two people and just doing these categories. I'm going to take Drew Barrymore with my last pick. I think in some ways she might actually be the most successful actor or actress across the board here who we have to select from. And so getting her with the final pick in the draft seems kind of crazy. But I think she has really good chemistry with Adam Sandler. And I get the impression they like working together just based on the number of movies they've ended up doing together. If we were going to go beyond the 90s, I could make an argument for Winona Ryder just because, you know, people who know me know that was kind of one of my very first celebrity crushes and one of my favorite actresses. And so, I might be inclined to take her from Mr. Deeds, but to more honor the spirit of this thing of the 90s, as well as just to honor the breadth of work and kind of what she brings to the table, I think Drew Barrymore is an easy pick with this sixth pick of the draft overall. So that gives me, you know, Drew Barrymore, Bradley Whitford, and Chris Farley. So sort of on a similar note, I could kind of do, Billy Madison again, except trade out, Bridget Wilson Sampras for Drew Barrymore, which I actually feel is a pretty big upgrade for that cast. So I'd be pretty happy to do that movie with all those players in. I think that's mostly a wrap on Adam Sandler. Any last thoughts about before we move into the last stages here, you know, about Adam Sandler, his movies, kind of what he meant in the 90s?
No, I think we covered a lot of ground with him. And like we said, you know, again, this is about the 90s, but we, he is an actor who seems to be making a shift in his career. And I think he still has a lot of, I believe he's got quite a few years left in his acting career that it'd be interesting to see kind of, how it'll shape up, you know, how his career will shape up and what it'll look like in a few years.
Now, I think if this dramatic turn for him works, I think that's going to add a whole nother chapter to his career in that vein. And if it doesn't work, I think actually by the next play for him would become more of a supporting actor and kind of become kind of almost like people like Chris Farley and Steve Buscemi were for his movies, become that kind of person for someone else's movie, especially someone more up and coming. I don't know. He also probably, I think you're right. He has enough in the bank at this point that I don't think he ever needs to do work again if he didn't want to. So yeah, it'd be interesting to see, you know, where he goes. Mm-hmm. But all right. So I want to say, you know, a thank you to everyone who's listened to us throughout this short season. You know, there were long episodes, a short season, so make of that what you will. I think we had a lot of fun recording this thing together and just kind of reliving this chapter of our lives, which, again, for anyone of, you know, our, you know, approximate generation, I think the 90s were, you know, an important and a memorable time. So certainly a fun one for us all to look back on. Mike, I think you want to say by way of thanks there?
No, I hope that this was relatable to a lot of the listeners, and or even if a few. I mean, it's you know, we're in the midst of a pandemic, so, you know, hopefully, I know we took this as an opportunity to do something that would bring us some joy and whatnot, you know, while we're each at home. So, you know, I hope for all of you listening that I hope that it kind of has done the same for you, whether or not this pandemic is over. Again, it's just something that, brings the, I don't know what the expression is, but finds the beam of sunlight in an otherwise kind of, you know, not ideal time. And
yeah, in, it's a cloudy day, so we're trying to find a little bit of sunlight.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, I think that's a really nice way of putting it. Yeah, and I'll say, yeah, you know, just, you know, a peek behind the curtain here. I mentioned this, you know, here and there, but we recorded all of these episodes before we've released them. So, you know, we're here on this episode 4, you know, talking about Adam Sandler. We don't know what your reactions are going to be. We don't know if at this point we have, you know, 2 or 3 listeners, or, you know, dozens of listeners, or hundreds or thousands. We just don't know the reach of this thing as we're recording it. But, you know, regardless, we appreciate those of us, you've given us a little bit of your time. Maybe not listen to every episode, but at least the ones that kind of speak to you or things that you were interested in that era. Yeah, I think we had some fun revisiting things that the both of us were into. You know, I think we each had our own interests well outside the media we talked about here. And if we do another season, we may very well might get into some more stuff that, you know, only one of us was into, or, you know, that we were into in different ways, or you know, more stuff along those lines. But anyway, thank you to listeners. Thanks, as always, to our friend Mike Peake for providing the theme music for the show. And otherwise, please be kind, rewind, and we'll see you down the road.